watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, it was necessary to interrupt the flow of the reading on the gift economy in order to bring you something that deals with an urgent matter: the necessity of the impeachment of President George W. Bush and Vice President Richard Cheney. Impeaching these men will not solve all the problems of America, but it will do one very crucial thing. It will halt the descent of this country into outright fascism and send a message to those who desire to rule us that we have had enough. That is because it is only a determined mass movement of the American people that will push a craven Congress to act, and thus it will demonstrate the awakening of the proper attitude of a free people. This forum, held last week in Binghamton, New York, is important not only for local listeners who are the constituents of Maurice Hinchey, but for all Americans. Here is as much of the evening as I could fit into my time slot.
As a moderator of our teach-in, we call it a teach-in, but it is more appropriate to say it's really a citizens' forum, a citizens' educational forum. So we all will have an opportunity to learn about and then to discuss one of the fundamental mechanisms of checks and balances in the U.S. Constitution to protect against the abuse of power by a president, a vice president, and all civil officers. That is the right of the House of Representatives to initiate an inquiry and, if warranted, to draw up articles of impeachment and have them tried in the U.S. Senate. Specifically, we have a panel, and you will hear from two scholars, a journalist and a lawyer, who have written books on the subject. You will hear from two political figures and activists, and two ordinary citizens. And we welcome your input during the question and answer period. We have given quite a bit of time so that you can really participate and engage the panelists themselves. So you will hear about the specific case to be made for and against the immediate impeachment of George W. Bush. After all, that is a right that falls to all of us as citizens, as individuals, as members of groups, to encourage local governments and state legislatures and our own House of Representatives to initiate an impeachment process by sending charges to Congress for them to act on. I need not fully remind you that this teach-in is part of a much wider movement around the country to initiate impeachment. 70 legislators in the state of Vermont have sent a letter to the Vermont congressional delegation in Washington, D.C. to urge the U.S. House to begin an investigation on possible impeachment. There are impeachment resolutions pending in 11 state legislatures. Many statewide and national political committees and legislative districts have taken a stand on the subject. 87 towns and municipalities have also passed impeachment resolutions, including the city of Ithaca, and we will hear from several people. Right. We will be hearing from several people at the forefront of one such successful issue. There also have been 38 cases, whether in municipalities or professional organizations, where such resolutions have either been defeated or tabled. Whatever position you take on the issue, it is a very valuable public debate about the policies and the actions of the current administration, the George W. Bush presidency, which claims such wide executive powers in its self-proclaimed war on terror. As an educational event itself, then, this teaching helps to restore more of a balance to our own system of government. We do have a number of changes, a last-minute cancellation, unfortunately, by Maurice Hinchy. That is, he had a serious family health matter come up that required him to travel out of the state this weekend, and his place is being taken by Dan Lamb, who is his district representative. And the same with Tim Griffin. He is not well, and his place has been taken by Jack Gilroy. Okay, I am now going to introduce the speakers in the order in which they will speak. And so that our first speaker is John Nichols. John Nichols has come in from Madison, and he is a regular correspondent with The Nation. He also has a very popular blog. It's called The Online Beat. I urge you to look at it. I did myself. It tracks progressive activism, which tends to be completely neglected by the mainstream media. It's very worth reading. Importantly, he has written a book entitled The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. So I know you're welcome, John.
Oh, you sound very good. Excellent. Excellent. Well, it is a delight to be in the part of New York that we Midwesterners don't hear much about. You know, it's all the talk of New York is always the city and all that. But coming from rural Wisconsin, as I drove into Binghamton last evening and saw all of your tall buildings, I felt I was definitely in the city. And so I thank all of our great hosts for their invitations. I must tell you that I am here this evening because of Sue Carlin, who lives in Smithville Flats, I think. Is that right? Yes. Okay, I'm hearing good. And Sue read my book when it came out a while back and had the incredibly audacious notion of sending a copy to every member of Congress. She raised the money, I assume, from some of you good folks, and succeeded in doing so, and I've been delighted to be able to tell her this evening as we were talking that I know of members of Congress who not only read the book, but because of the book, signed on to Congressman Dennis Kucinich's proposal to impeach Vice President Pence. I can think of no activism more significant than that, and so, though my wife tells me I travel too much for the cause of impeachment, she's in favor of it, but just it takes a little bit of time out of our family life. When I said that Sue had invited me to come to Binghamton, she said, well, you gotta go, because she's one activist who actually gets things done. So I'm honored to be with Sue this evening and also with you. I want to also pay tribute to the folks from Ithaca and Tompkins County. Tompkins County, the first county in the United States to vote for impeachment of the president. Let me also note that I'm sorry that Maurice is not here tonight. Maurice Hinchy is one of the most outstanding members of Congress by any measure. In another life, I am co-founder of Free Press, the nation's media reform network, and I will tell you this, there were two members of Congress when we started going up to Washington 5 years ago and saying, you know, look, we've got to do something about concentrated media and its absolute failure to cover the fundamental issues in this country. There were two members of Congress who came out before, we didn't have to tell them anything. They said, I'm on board, what do we need to do? One of them was Bernie Sanders, who is now a U.S. Senator. And the other was Maurice Hinchey. And by God, if Hillary Clinton gets elected president, I sure hope that Maurice Hinchey will be a U.S. Senator as well. Finally, I pay note of the fact that I am on a panel with Betsy De La Vega. We were together about a year ago, and we said, okay, we're going to spread out in opposite directions across the country, and we'll meet next October in Binghamton and see how we've done. And so I'm delighted to say that we have done some interesting things over the past year. I'm jealous of Betsy because I did get to appear on Bill Moyers' show to talk about these issues, but she got to appear on Stephen Colbert's The Colbert Report. So please, there. Now, George Bush went to Australia recently. Now, Australia is the United States' chief ally in the war in Iraq. Most countries in the so-called coalition of the willing were actually forced through economic pressures or others to become part of the coalition of the willing. But Australian ambassador, or Australian Prime Minister John Howard, actually supports the war. Now, intriguingly enough, that distinguishes him from all Americans. But he supports the war, he wanted the Australian troops there, and George Bush felt it was necessary to go to Australia and thank John Howard and the Australians for committing their troops to the effort in Iraq. And so the President of the United States, the leader of the free world, stood before his chief ally in the war in Iraq and before the people of the country that has sent more troops than any nation except the U.S. and Britain to this war, and proudly and boldly and in his deepest Texas voice, thanked the Austrian army for its commitment to the struggle. It is with respect for his intellect and his commitment that I speak this evening of the president, and also of another American who was in Australia during the week that the president was there, my friend Matt Howard. Matt is a Marine who served in the initial invasion of Iraq. Matt joined me for a dozen stops throughout the state of Vermont earlier this year when Cindy Sheehan and I toured that state to urge Vermonters to pass local impeachment resolutions. More than 40 towns in Vermont did so. It was a very successful initiative, led to the Vermont State Senate passing its resolution as well. I would love to tell you that Cindy and I were the forces that caused Vermonters to act, but I think Matt Howard was a much more powerful voice, and it is why I was so glad he was down in Australia at his own expense to challenge George Bush's line on the war. Matt has gone all over this country for that cause, but the thing that blew me away was when I appeared with him up across his home state of Vermont, and he told the story of the first day of the invasion of Iraq. Matt and the other Marines were given a half hour of cultural training to understand one of the oldest countries on the planet. They were given no language training whatsoever, and they were told to drive north on that great superhighway from Kuwait City to Baghdad. I know it is hard to imagine today, but once Iraq had superhighways and hospitals and schools and a functional, if imperfect, country, it is now the quagmire that we have made it. But Matt Howard and those Marines headed north, and they were told, you've got to keep going, keep driving. When you come to a crossroads, one of the Marines just jump out, stop the traffic coming across, but keep heading north, keep heading for Baghdad, and so they did. They came to the first major crossroads. The young Marine in Matt's truck, Matt was a truck driver, the young Marine jumped out. No cultural training of consequence, no language training whatsoever. And he stood at that crossroads, and he did what a Marine will do. He put his arm up with a clenched fist and said, "Halt!" And the car, a Mercedes-Benz with a mother, father, and six children in it, came to a halt. And then the man driving the car reached out of the window, being a member of the Ba'athist Party, and gave the international sign of solidarity, feeling that that is what he had gotten from the Marine. And when he put his arm back in, he put his car in gear and drove forward, because, of course, he had had this interaction, this communication with the American Marine. And the Marines at that site shot and killed everyone in the car. That evening, because our president and all of those people who support the troops did not send the proper gear, tents, and things like that along for the invasion, this soldier slept in Matt's truck. Every few minutes, he would stir from his restless sleep and scream out. Matt finally put his arms around him and he said, "It's okay, brother. You have to understand, bad things happen in a war." And slowly, the man, the Marine, would drift back to sleep. And he would stir again and scream out. And Matt said, "Brother, you gotta just take it easy, man. Bad things happen in a war." And this young man said, "You don't understand. You don't understand. I am a Christian, and I am responsible for the deaths of innocent men, women, and children on the first day of this war. I'm going to hell. Don't you understand that?" And Matt tried to reason with him, but in the end he said he couldn't. And when I think about the fact of what we are doing to our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters, our parents, in that quagmire that is Iraq, and when I think what we are doing to the innocent people of Iraq, I despair. And when I hear our president speak of sending tens of thousands of additional troops into Iraq in a surge, men and women as beautiful and good as Matt Howard and that other Marine, I despair. And when I hear the Vice President of the United States speak casually about launching a more extensive, more deadly, and more dramatically dangerous war against the nation of Iran, I despair. And when I see members of our Congress elected to end this war debate non-binding resolutions, which by their very nature confirm their irrelevance, I despair. And then I come out on a Saturday night in Binghamton, New York, and I see all these good people. I see Sue Carlin and all these other folks, and I think to myself, I don't have the indulgence. I don't have the right to despair. I don't have that privilege as an American citizen. I have a responsibility to stand before you this evening and to say, courage, patriots. We are descendants of revolutionaries who fought a war against a king named George. And you are right. You are right. The Constitution has been attacked. The Republic itself is in danger. Democracy has been undermined. But we were given a Constitution with which to respond to all of these challenges. And so I stand before you this evening and I say, my name is John Nichols, and I want to impeach the President and the Vice President of the United States. I want to impeach them because they lied to the American people and the Congress of the United States about the reasons for attacking, invading, and occupying the sovereign nation of Iraq. I want to impeach them because that is a violation of the system of checks and balances established by the founders and requiring that a president cooperate always with Congress in a time of war. The president has committed an impeachable offense. I want to impeach them because George Bush has authorized the illegal, warrantless wiretapping of our telephones and the reading of our emails in direct violation, not of the FISA Act, which sounds like a bit of bureaucracy, something you put on the back of your income tax form, but in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which guarantees us freedom in our homes from interventions and spying and interruptions by our government. The president has committed an impeachable act. I want to impeach them because they have sanctioned torture. And because while the Geneva Conventions bar torture, so too does the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which bars cruel and unusual punishment against those held in the custody of the American government. The president and the vice president have committed impeachable acts. I want to impeach them because of what they did to Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame and to all of the other people who dared dissent against their regime. The third article of impeachment against Richard Nixon was for using his office to achieve political goals, to undermine, to criticize, to harm his political critics. The president and the vice president have committed an impeachable act. Now I know that there are people who tell you, well, you know, it's true, everything you say is true, but it's really late. Right? It's very, very late. You know, we're going to have a presidential election soon. Can't we just hold our breath for the next 14 months?
No.
I mean, can't we just, you know, let Bush finish it out? Because, well, it might be politically advantageous for the Democrats if we don't apply the Constitution. And, you know, there's timelines. We're talking about timelines for telling the president when he can do things and stuff like that. And you know, whenever I hear that, I think of another timeline. Every 10 minutes in Iraq, an innocent Iraqi civilian is killed in this war. Every 10 hours in Iraq, an American soldier is killed in this war. Every 10 days, $2 billion, $2 billion are removed from the U.S. Treasury and poured into the coffers of Halliburton and Blackwater and all of the other profiteers who have grown rich on this war. 10 minutes, 10 hours, 10 days. That's the timeline I think about. Don't tell me George Bush's presidency is almost done as he talks of going to war with Iran. Don't tell me that we can wait this out when every 10 minutes an Iraqi mother buries her child, when every 10 hours an American mother buries her child, when every 10 days the money that could rebuild New Orleans, that could give us a national health care plan, that could make this country the envy of the world, is spent off to the war profiteers. 10 minutes, 10 hours, 10 days. We have enough time to hold this president and this vice president to account. Now, I want to tell you that I'm a really smart guy. I know all this great stuff, and I came up with all these good ideas, but I didn't. The founders of the American Republic came up with these ideas. George Mason, the essential author of the Bill of Rights, said, "No point is of more importance in the American Constitution than the right of impeachment, and that it should be continued. It answers the eternal question, shall any man be above justice? James Madison, the essential author of the document itself, said, it may perhaps on some occasion be found necessary to impeach the president himself. Do not fear this day, citizens. It is what we fought for when we said we would no longer be ruled by kings. Thomas Jefferson said, to fail to impeach a president who has violated his oath of office makes him a king for 4 years and makes our Constitution an irrelevant document, because if a president cannot be held to account for his violations of the Constitution, then the Constitution cannot protect any of us in any sense. George Mason, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, they wrote a Constitution for the purposes of chaining the dogs of war, and they said that there was no point at which a Congress is more required to impeach than in a time of war. Madison said, war is the true wet nurse of executive aggrandizement. In a time of war, a president will use the fear of a foreign country to impose fear upon his own country. A president will decrease our liberties. He will empty the treasury into the accounts of his friends and business partners. And he will ultimately make America not the country of revolution against royalty, but a colony to the president himself. Now, these basic concepts of our Constitution, given to us by our founders with the intent that we would use them, have been used repeatedly throughout the history of the Republic. Impeachment is not talked about enough in our history. It is not talked about enough in our media. You know that when Betsy was on Colbert's show, that was one of the longest periods on national television devoted to the subject of impeachment. They did 4.5 minutes. When I was on the Moyer show, we did an hour. And the incredible thing about it was we had hundreds of thousands of responses. And you know what people said? All across America, they said, wow, thank you. I thought I was going crazy. I thought we lived in a constitutional republic that said presidents had to be impeached when they committed these acts and nothing had happened. Thank you for saying it. And yet, after that hour, there's not been another hour of television since devoted to this subject. We live in a country where impeachment is put off the table. But let me tell you, impeachment has been on the table before. 10 presidents have faced the threat of impeachment. We've brought it to Congress many times, and it has always served us well. It has always caused presidents, when threatened with impeachment, remember Nixon wasn't impeached, when threatened with impeachment, to back off and back away from their illegality. It is an essential tool, even if it is not taken to its final stage. And it is an essential tool, especially in a time of war. You know, and let me close with this story. In the worst war this country ever fought, before the current one, the war against Mexico in the 1840s, when a slave-holding president, James K. Polk, decided that the only way to protect the original sin of the American experiment, slavery, was to invade Mexico, carve its regions up into states all south of the Mason-Dixon line, and declare them to be slave states, thus ensuring forever that human bondage would remain on the North American continent. When James K. Polk initiated that war, a young congressman elected on an anti-war ticket arrived in Washington and went on a daily basis to the floor of the House to challenge the honesty of the president, to say, you lied us into this war. There was never a threat. It is an illegal and immoral war. And this young congressman worked with the oldest member of Congress, the former president, John Quincy Adams, to censure the president of the United States for leading this country into an illegal and immoral war, and began to speak of impeaching him for his crimes. And the young congressman's partner sent him a letter, and he said, my friend, you can't speak ill of the president in a time of war. Think of the troops. Think of the responsibilities that you have to the republic. You cannot talk of impeaching a president in a time of war. And the congressman wrote back, the provision of the Constitution Giving the war-making power to Congress was dictated, as I understand it, by the following reasons. Kings had always been involved and involving and impoverishing their people in wars, pretending generally, if not always, that the good of the people was the object of the war. This, our Constitutional Convention understood to be the most oppressive of all kingly oppressions, and they resolved to so frame the Constitution that no one man should hold the power of bringing this oppression upon the American people. Your suggestion that presidents must be allowed to make war as they choose, and to be free from criticism, to be free from the threat of removal from office during the time of war, destroys the whole matter of the American Republic and places our president where kings have always stood. I was not elected to serve a king. Sincerely, Abraham Lincoln. It is not too late to tell James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln that they were right about the American Republic and the American experiment. It is not too late to renew the Constitution. It is not too late to restore the rule of law. It is not too late, indeed. It is our moral, political, and patriotic responsibility to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. Thank you very much.
Now we can welcome Elizabeth de la Vega. Elizabeth has come from Northern California, and she is a former federal prosecutor. She was a member of the organized crime strike force. She was chief of the San Jose branch of the U.S. Attorney Office for the Northern District of California. She has retired now, and she has taken up writing. She writes for the LA Times, for Salon, also for The Nation, and as you know, she has written a book which is entitled The United States versus George W. Bush et al. So let's welcome Elizabeth.
Hello, everybody. I am very happy to be here as well as John is. When I was first invited to Binghamton, I have to confess I really didn't know very much about Binghamton. And I called a friend of mine who went to college here at SUNY, and he had talked about it often in very glowing terms. So I called him, and his name is Yonkel. And I said, Yonkel, tell me about Binghamton. I'm going there, I want to hear about it. And there was this long silence. And he said, well, it was great. I loved going to school here. But it was in the late 60s, and I can't remember anything about the late 60s. So that didn't really help me very much. But fortunately, I've met some new friends here, as I have around the country, including George Hassler, who I thank very much for inviting me here, and Jack Gilroy, who picked me up at the airport along with, is it Stefan? Stefan. And they gave me a quick history lesson. And I have to tell you, I felt immediately at home here, and I didn't know why until Jack explained to me that this used to be a town of shoe factories. And I am the granddaughter, the proud granddaughter of a man who worked in a shoe factory in Lynn, Massachusetts for 40 years. So I don't know if it was genetic or what. When we were introduced in various ways, and then some of us were introduced as ordinary citizens. I want to tell you that we are all at the same time ordinary citizens, and we are all at the same time extraordinary citizens. I am here for the very same reason that each and every one of you is here. And that is because I have great reverence for the system of government that we have in this country. And I love the Constitution of the United States. And I miss it. We haven't seen it in action for a good many, many years. Now, as you heard from Joan, I spent 21 years as an assistant United States attorney. And I was working, in fact, as an assistant United States attorney in 2002, July of 2002, when I heard President Bush get up and make one of his many speeches in front of the sign that tells you what you're supposed to understand from the speech in case you can't understand what he, in fact, is saying. And this particular one was about corporate responsibility. It was July 30th, 2002, and he was announcing the enactment of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the corporate crime bill, in response, in part at least, to the Enron fraud. And he said something along the lines of, thenceforth, or I'm sure he didn't say thenceforth, from here on in, it will be illegal for CEOs to lie to their investors about the finances of their company. Well, that struck me as odd because I've been working for all those years and it had already been illegal for CEOs to lie to their investors. So even when he was announcing a corporate crime bill, he was defrauding the people of this country. What I didn't know at the time was that on that very day, and for many months beforehand and after, the president and his senior advisors, including the vice president, were embarked on the largest fraud we've ever had in this country. When President Bush announced the corporate crime bill, he talked about tricking investors into making investments as a crime. Well, tricking the nation into a war against people 8,000 miles away who have done absolutely nothing to us, who have no ability whatsoever to do anything to us, nor do they even have any desire to do anything to us, tricking the nation into war is a crime. So, I took early retirement in 2004 in the fall, and by that time, I was aware, like the rest of you, much of the extent of the fraud. And one of the things that particularly concerned me, and Joan asked me, well, why did you write this book? You must have been really, really angry. And I have to tell you, I was not only really angry, I was ashamed and just absolutely discouraged to see the nature of the debate, if you can call it that, on television, and in particular to find or to discover that the president could be reelected if he was in fact reelected. I'm not sure about that. But in any case, some of the things I would hear would be along the lines of, well, the president couldn't have intentionally deceived the public because he didn't know anything, because he didn't read anything. And even people who were critics of the president actually accepted that as a valid point. Well, I thought it might be worthwhile for me, as someone who prosecuted many people who committed fraud, to explain to the public that if you are in a position of authority, whether you're the president or a life insurance salesman or someone selling pharmaceutical products, and you're setting about to convince people of something, you have an obligation to find out the basis for what you're saying. If you don't have a basis for what you're saying, then that's one form of fraud. It's called a statement made with reckless disregard for the truth. So either the president was defrauding the public by making statements recklessly without regard to whether they were true or false, or he had looked into what the facts actually were and he was deliberately lying. So that was one thing I kept hearing. Another thing I kept hearing was, Well, these people actually believed that there were weapons of mass destruction. Well, I thought it might be important for people to know, and I explained the law in the book in quite a bit more detail, but important for people to know that almost every person who tries to con somebody else convinces themselves that the outcome will be good. But the law tells jurors in every single criminal case involving fraud that it's not okay, it's no defense, regardless of what you think the outcome of your scheme is going to be, it's no defense if you lie along the way to get people to go along with it. In other words, you can't lie to people to get them to do what you want just because you think it's going to be good for them. So that was another point I wanted to make. And then the third point I wanted to make was that while the president was saying, well, I just relied on other people. He picked different ones. And just went along with what they said. Well, that was a big defense in the Enron case. Jeffrey Skilling and Ken Lay would say, well, we just said what our underlings told us. And every single person on that jury understood the fallacy of that argument, and it's not what the law says. Again, if you are in charge of an operation, you're required to know what is going on. You can't hoist it off on your underlings. And so my decision was, well, I'll write this book. I had no idea if anybody would ever publish it. And I set about to prepare the case of fraud just as I would prepare any other case. And that's what I've done in the book. And my point was not that the president or vice president should be indicted, although there is a hypothetical indictment in here, and some people find it really therapeutic just to have. And in fact, when I wrote the book, I wasn't even writing about impeachment. My goal at the time, and this was the summer of 2006, was that we needed Congress to do the right thing. We needed Congress to oversee and do what they're supposed to do. And in fact, in the introduction to the book, I talk about an incident that really explains my motivation. And that is the incident involving Kitty Genovese, whom many of you know about, I'm sure. A woman who was walking home from Queens, in Queens, in the early 60s, and she was stabbed repeatedly over a half an hour period. There were 38 neighbors who heard or saw this incident, and nobody called the police. Well, this incident was seen as an example of urban indifference, but a study was done and it showed that, in fact, it wasn't so much that people were indifferent, but rather that they thought, number one, that somebody else would do something about it, or they thought that if nobody else was doing anything about it, it couldn't really be that bad. Now, a year later, since I've written this book, we have a situation that's just as horrific as it was a year before. In some ways, things have changed. In some ways, in the worst ways, they've absolutely stayed the same. And I thought a lot about what I was going to say this evening because I knew that either Maurice Hinchey or his representative, Dan Lamb, was going to be here. And I want to say that I really appreciate him being here, and I have the greatest admiration for Maurice Hinchey. But at the same time, I think it's really important, and this is my only chance, to say what I want to say to congressmen, to the progressive congresspeople, who are the people on whom we rely more than anything. It's not easy being a progressive congressperson, I can imagine. And I, as a public servant for many years, I know what that feeling is like. You're trying to do the right thing and it's still not enough. But nevertheless, these are the people, these men and women are the ones we really need. And so I'm not going to hold back. And because the position that I believe Congressman Hinchey is taking is the very same position that my congressman, Mike Honda, is taking, and he just wrote my husband and me a letter in which he said, yes, we believe that the president has, or I believe that the president has committed impeachable offenses. But, and these were his exact words in the letter, the stark, undeniable reality is that we cannot get the two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict the president. Well, I want to say that is not true, and it is not the stark, undeniable reality. The only way someone can take that position is by completely closing one's eyes to what is really the reality. Because the undeniable reality is that this president has defrauded the country about the war, has defrauded Congress, and the only way you can take the position we're not going to do anything about it is by closing your eyes to it. The undeniable and actually... It's not just the undeniable reality, it's the provable reality. We can prove without a single additional subpoena. And that is really one of the reasons I wrote this book as well, is that we don't need any more hearings. We have everything we need to know. We can prove in small ways and in large about every single aspect of this war that the Bush administration, Cheney, President Bush, and so many others defrauded Congress and the public about everything. Start from, you can take any date almost. September 4th, 2002, the president told the American people and Congress, we're having an open dialogue about this war. What had happened by that date? He had a formal war plan. There had been meeting after meeting after meeting with General Tommy Franks and Donald Rumsfeld and the entire War Council. We had sent the soldiers from Afghanistan over to Iraq, taking them away from looking for Osama bin Laden and putting them over in Iraq. We had the CIA over in Iraq trying to foment the insurgency. We had Cheney had gone to every single country around Iraq in March of 2002, and he, when asked about it on TV, Condoleezza Rice said he only went there because he's got a lot of friends over there. By July, Donald Rumsfeld had authorized to be executed more than 50 airstrikes, likely to kill more than 35 Iraqi civilians. They'd already been executed. We don't know how many were executed that were likely to kill fewer than that number because they didn't even have to be authorized. On July 30th, the date that the president was announcing that tricking investors into making investments was a crime, he had secretly caused to be moved $700 million of funds from Afghanistan to Iraq war appropriations. That was what had happened before the open dialogue started. The day after the open dialogue, we don't have to do any subpoenas to prove these things. The day after the open dialogue, we launched the largest number of airstrikes against Iraq that we'd launched since 1998. We know that when Vice President Cheney was telling us in December of 2001 that there was a link between Iraq and 9/11 because there was a meeting between Mohammed Atta in Prague and the head of Iraqi intelligence, we know we don't have to do any more investigation. That, and he said it was pretty well confirmed. We know that was deceptive because it hadn't even been investigated. If somebody came out and said something was pretty well confirmed about a medical product and they hadn't even done the tests, that person would be prosecuted for fraud. And we know that as he kept saying that, not only was it investigated ultimately, but found to be absolutely untrue because the FBI found evidence that Mohammed Atta was in Florida at that time. There's example after example. Some of them are simple, some of them are a little more complex. When we had Rice, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, General Myers on September 8, 2002, talking about aluminum tubes that were only suited for use in nuclear centrifuge. We know from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report that we already have. It's already there. We know that there were 14 reports about those aluminum tubes. 12 of them said that that conclusion was highly controversial. And one of them, according to the Senate Select Committee report, was in the President's daily brief. And the reason we knew about these tubes, all laid out in these reports, is because they were seized from the Iraqis because they were ordering them on the internet. Whether it was Craigslist, eBay, I do not know. Out of these 12 reports, 6 of them said that it was not only in dispute, but highly unlikely that the tubes could be used for a centrifuge because they were 3 times too long, they were covered with a coating that would have to be taken off, they were 3 times too thick, the metal, they were half the diameter that you would need. And as one of the experts put it at the time in the report, maybe you could turn these into tubes suitable for use in a centrifuge in the same way that you could turn a Yugo into a Cadillac if you worked at it hard enough. All this is provable. It's provable that when President Bush came out in front of the entire country and world and Congress in March of 2003 and said we had to invade Iraq because they weren't cooperating with the inspectors, that was an absolute flat-out lie. The inspectors were begging us not to invade Iraq. They were saying, these inspections are working, they're not perfect, but please do not invade Iraq. I could go on and on. We know the undeniable, provable reality is that President Bush and Vice President Cheney have presided over the violation not only of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but of our Fourth Amendment rights for years. Not only they've admitted it, that's admissible evidence. And it's pretty easy to prove. We don't have to get any other documents from them. We don't have to be rely on the kindness of the administration in order to prove that they have been deceiving us. And not only have they violated the law in this regard, but every time Congress has tried to get information, they have obstructed Congress. We still do not have whatever is the supposed legal rationale for the violation of the FISA law. Now, if there really were one that existed at the time, there's no reason for them not to explain what it was. What inferences can we draw? Maybe there wasn't one. They have not only deceived us time and time again about FISA, they've deceived the courts. They've done all kinds of machinations to avoid having to address these issues in the courts. And finally, the undeniable reality, the provable reality, is that this administration, Bush and Cheney, have presided over a reign of torture that is unprecedented in this country. Clearly, we know that in the past this government has tortured people, but it has never been the admitted policy of this country that we torture people. And it's not simply that it's a violation of the Geneva Convention, which would be bad enough. It's a violation of our own laws. For those of you who don't have your statute books here, it's 18 U.S.C. Section 2430. And again, not only are they committing these heinous acts and deceiving us about it for years, regardless of whatever efforts Congress makes to investigate, obstructing Congress at every turn and lying to Congress over and over and over again, doing secret memos and so forth, they pretend now that they simply can't even tell us what the definition of torture is. Anybody who heard Dana Perino do her press conference recently about that, she said, well, it's just so complicated. You have to read this lawyer's memo, and she actually asked somebody, were you able to get through it? I couldn't get through it. Well, that my friends, is a huge deceit. And not only is it a huge deceit, it's completely at odds with what the Bush administration Department of Justice is saying in another matter in a courtroom in Florida that is pending right now. We have charged the son of Charles Taylor, the president of Liberia, with torture. He's charged under the statute I just mentioned. And in that case, did the Department of Justice lawyers, by the way, these look like real lawyers to me, who are actually trying to redress injustices. What do they say about how you explain torture and whether or not it's vague? This is all they said. He's charged with specifically intending to inflict severe physical pain. An ordinary person would know that the type of conduct described in detail in the indictment is prohibited. An ordinary person, and yes, an ordinary person does know that it is prohibited to inflict a combination of psychological and physical actual suffering and threat of suffering, including simulated drownings, head slappings, on and on and on. And those are just the things that they seem to be admitting to now. We know that they've been doing these things and lying about them for years, and now they're trying to tell us it's too complicated. Now, you don't have to violate laws to commit impeachable offenses. Impeachable offenses are those which are serious abuses of power that go to the governance of the country. But as it happens, in lying about the war, in violating the Fourth Amendment, in violating the FISA statute, in sanctioning and endorsing and carrying out torture in the way that they have and lying about it and obstructing Congress, this administration has done all of the above. So, in order for anybody to say we can't do anything about this because the stark, undeniable reality is that we can't get the votes, that is denying the reality of all of these actions. And maybe it won't succeed. We don't know. It's an investigation. An impeachment is an investigation. But are there grounds to start this investigation? There's no question that there are grounds. So when people ask me, what do I tell other people? Because I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I have to tell you, and John talked about this with me earlier, it gets discouraging. And I know all of you get discouraged. But when I feel that way, I like to think of the statements of two women who lived about 100 years apart. One of them is Molly Ivins. And she said, as many of you know, something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, if you are concerned about this war, if you want to hold the administration accountable, do something every day. And nobody knows exactly what to do. We never do. And nobody knows what will come of what we do. But the very least we can do leads me to the statement by another woman whom I admire greatly, and that is Louisa May Alcott. And most of you know who she is, of course, and I did grow up outside of near Concord, and she was kind of one of my childhood idols, and I read a lot about her. And when in the 1880s, she was, she was an abolitionist all of her life, as were her family members.